position number 21296, wheel 4.
Alan Tate, wheel 4.
They were building a bailey bridge across the River Elbe and getting on quite well with it. And I walked down into the village street, which was parallel with the river, so that the houses closest to the river actually had gardens that went down to the water. There was a gap in the houses, so you could get access to the river. And there were some engineers standing there talking. And one of them was saying, "I think this is just about right." They were discussing where to make the landing place. "But," he said, "we'll have to take this house down." The lady of the house was standing at the gate, very interested in what was going on, couldn't understand a word. But of course, when they got the bridge built, the first vehicle across was a bulldozer, which they drove right through her house, so she must have been upset. The second thing that happened there was, while the bridge was actually under construction, a German aeroplane came over. It was a 109. Must have been one of the last aeroplanes they had in use. And he came over, started his dive to the bridge. They had lots of Bofa guns firing away. And this plane appeared to be caught in a vortex of fire. And he started spinning. And everybody thought he'd been hit. And the gunners stopped firing. And he was down to about 1,000 feet. And he straightened up, dropped a bomb on the bridge, and then flew away up the river, following the course of the river as he went. Do you know, there were about 20 men where I was standing, and they started cheering. "You know, well done," they said. The engineers didn't think it was well done. Some of them were hurt. But anyway, it was the last German aeroplane I saw.
Was the bridge damaged?
No, not severely. They finished the bridge on time. And they brought over, obviously, armour. And they brought over also a small contingent of SAS, three men to a jeep, with Browning machine guns mounted on the front and something else on the back. And they proved to be a first-class nuisance. The object then was to get to Lübeck, to cut off Schleswig-Holstein and Denmark, because the Russians had met Rostock, and if they'd got to Lübeck, they could turn right and cut off the whole peninsula. So it became very important to get to Lübeck as quickly as possible. Naturally, the tank boys made straight for it. We followed on, and we came to a village I was leading with my lads, and we came to a little crest looking towards a village called Lutau. And there were Germans, four abreast, marching down the road towards us in broad daylight. Couldn't believe it. Anyway, the word went back, and we had mountain artillery who came with us. They were jolly good chaps. Very bad guns, very short barrels, very worn, very inaccurate, but they made a satisfactory bang. And they ranged on these Germans walking down the road. Mortar men and heavy machine gunners joined in, and they killed quite a few of them. The story was that they had encountered the SAS, who had told them, "Just march down that road and you can surrender." Didn't tell us. So naturally, the Germans were very put out, and many of them went into the village of Lutau, which is a broad village green, houses either side, at right angles to our line of advance. And of course they weren't going to surrender. So there was a bit of a battle. And we lost a sergeant who'd been with the unit since D-Day. And I approached the village from the south with my merry men. It was a case of fire away and run like hell across the village green. I got across the village green, ran round the back of a house. Again, door was open, back cellar door was open. And remembering what had happened in Wesel, I always carried four grenades. I took a grenade off my belt, pulled the pin out, swung my arm back, and a baby cried out. Christ. So I put it back, put the pin in, and said, "Come to here," or something silly like that. And the woman came up with her hands up. Makes you feel like a real bastard, you know. Anyway, she came up. There was a man. There was an old granny person. The entire family had been in the basement. So I was offered coffee and we all ended up drinking coffee. But I've often thought about that. Talk about making a big mistake. Anyway, didn't make a big mistake. And the next day, my uniform was absolutely filthy and covered with mud. And my batman undertook to clean it. So I found a particularly attractive knickerbocker suit in a wardrobe, dark green loading cloth, complete with hat and feather. So I put on my knickerbocker suit. My lads thought that was really quite fetching. And I went for a walk down the street and somebody came running after me, said, "Would I please come back, Captain Riley?" No, "Please come back. We were to help in the search of a nearby wood, make sure there weren't any Germans, for which purpose we had been loaned a Bren gun carrier." So I hurried back. But when I got back, Peter Riley, Captain Riley, who was my troop commander at that time, had gone off in the Bren gun, just for a ride around the woods. Ran over a mine, of course. Yeah, well, when I got back, Peter Riley had already gone off in this wretched Bren gun carrier, ran over a mine, and he was very badly hurt. He wasn't killed, but he was badly hurt. Two other people in the carrier were killed, and the last one was hurt. So I thought that had really an interesting day. Nearly succeeded in killing a German baby. Nearly got myself blown up in a Bren gun carrier. But actually these things had not happened to me. And that was about the 6th or 7th of May, 1945. And as we were moving on to Lübeck, of course the war finished. So we had a holiday by the seaside at Eutin on the Baltic. And that was in. And then we were visited by a general, I don't know who it was now, Richie or somebody, who came and made a good speech about the fact that we'd all done very well and the airborne after Arnhem had all gone to Buckingham Palace, the whole lot of them. Were the survivors. And 1st Commando Brigade would have the same honour. We would all go to Buckingham Palace en masse. And we planned a big party. We were going to lead a white tape from Trafalgar Square to Buckingham Palace and we're all going to walk up it, we said. And the next day I was told I was going to the Far East. So we never got to the palace. Went instead to Singapore and then on to China.
Can you take me through that, please?
Well, we went to Singapore for a thing called Operation Zipper, which was to be a landing on the coast of Malaya. And you know, the landing was to take place in a heavily mined mangrove swamp. And the theory was that the Germans would never have thought.
The Japanese?
No. The Germans would never have thought that we'd land in such a place. But of course, we weren't fighting the Germans at that stage. And the Japanese had worked it out. Filthy Orientals will think that we will not think that they would think to land in such a place was heavily defended. And I had spent several weeks learning how to take Japanese mines apart. I discovered I'd volunteered, I hadn't realised it quite, I'd volunteered to go in a small boat, together with others of course, into this mangrove swamp and dismantle the mines. Of course it was all a big spoof. We would have set off one or two and all the others would have gone off by sympathetic detonation. Never mind, we didn't have to do it because the Japanese surrendered. So we had Mountbatten come aboard the ship. We were on HMS Raja, and he told us how the British had been fighting more Japanese than the Americans had. which was almost true, actually. I mean, there was quite a big Japanese army in Burma. Went on to Hong Kong, took the surrender.
What impression did Mountbatten make on you?
He wasn't, in my view, if I can use this word, he wasn't gritty enough. He wasn't earthy enough. He wasn't unsophisticated enough to have been like, for example, General Slim was. He'd never actually been in a mangrove swamp. He'd never actually sat in a hole while it rained mortar bombs or shells. But he was very competent at what he was doing. He was more like, I mean, Noel Coward played him in a movie, as you know. And I think Mountbatten was more like Noel Coward than Noel Coward was. He was awfully smart, had a very well-cut white suit, and very small, but of course all royal people are smaller when you meet them than you think they are, aren't they? And Montgomery, of course, was very small, but he had a photographer. I was photographed with Montgomery, and his photographer rushed round behind the general and knelt down on the ground and did the photo, pointing up, so that actually he looked taller than me, but he's just the same size. But he had more medals. Mountbatten was a bit like that, I thought. Is the word superficial appropriate? See, he'd had a very privileged upbringing, and his promotion had been accelerated because of who he was. You couldn't say, as you might have said, of Zhukov or Timoshenko or those great Russian generals, or indeed, as you might have said of some of our generals, or perhaps some of the German generals. You couldn't say that he was in that league. He had done well, I thought. But would he have done as well if he hadn't been so well connected? I don't know. Anyway, he looked the part. So then went on to China and had a holiday, really. I was garrison commander on Ping Chau. I've been back there since.
Where's Ping Chau?
Tiny little island, about 3 hours by ferry from Hong Kong. It has, if you're familiar with the Paps of Glencoe, twin hills, of course. It's just like two hills sticking out of the water, joined by a strip of sand. But there was a factory making matches, therefore explosives, therefore attractive to pirates. Therefore had to be defended. So we defended it. Didn't have, it was just as easy to defend as the Sunderland and South Shields water pumping station had been, i.e. it was never attacked.
Did you see any pirates?
No. They existed all right, and the last time they had attacked the island, they had had automatic weapons, among other things. And interesting, I was reading in the Times just a couple of months ago about pirates in those part of the world. Of course, they've got high-speed launchers now. And no doubt all stay at Raffles Hotel.
What was the attitude of the Hong Kong population to the return of British troops?
I never really met any civilians in Hong Kong, though I did go to the war trials, the war crimes trials. But I did meet some civilians in Singapore. We were in Singapore, and I was walking down the street, minding my own business, and a group of four Marines came towards me. And they'd been, by this time, as a troop commander. And they came towards me. And I said, hello, lads, where are you going? Oh, just out for a walk. And I said, would you like a cup of tea? And they said, oh, yeah, good idea. And I was outside a hotel. I now know it was Raffles Hotel. And I went into the foyer with these four lads. And there's a big room inside with comfortable chairs and tables. And people were sitting having tea, civilians. And the manager came hurrying across the floor And he said, can I help you, sir? I said, yes. Want a table, five people, tea. And he said, I'm terribly sorry, I can't serve you. I said, why not? He said, you haven't got a tie. I said, I have got a tie, but it's 8,000 miles away. Well, I'm terribly sorry, I can't serve. I now know what it was all about. I could have been served. I was a Royal Marine officer at the time. These chaps were just ordinary Marines. They weren't going to serve them. And these civilians all sat there watching this performance. And I think I don't regret anything during the war as much as I regret the fact that I didn't stand my ground. You know, saying, you serve them tea or I shall do something violent. But he got away with it. So a few years ago, I had to go to the university at Singapore to give a lecture, would you believe? And we stayed at a modern hotel, which is about a mile high, about 100 yards from Raffles. And I said to my wife, darling, I said, I'm going to have a cup of tea at Raffles Hotel. And she said, why? And I told her. So we went down in the elevator, went round to Raffles Hotel. It was fast closed, boarded up and locked, because they were refurbishing it. So I still didn't get my cup of tea at Raffles. But I think I would say the attitude of the civilians I did meet was that generally I don't think they were particularly grateful. They didn't go as far out of their way to welcome the relieving forces as the Dutch had gone. They didn't go as far out of their way as Americans in Midwestern towns did for RAF crews who were there training. I remember a pal of mine who went down to learn to fly Catalinas on the Gulf of Mexico, and en route, they went by train of course, they were interviewed at some station, a microphone was pushed in somebody's face and he was asked, what do you miss most about England? And he said, Brussels sprouts. The lads were invited out for dinner to various houses, and apparently the local population turned the place upside down to find Brussels sprouts. But a nice gesture.
When you make these observations about civilians in Singapore, are you referring to European civilians?
Oh, yes. Yes, Europeans. That's interesting. The Chinese were, on the whole, very, very respectful. But I came to the conclusion that they were acting as the Greeks did when the Turks occupied Crete and decreed that nobody could be in a position of power unless they were Muslims, and all the Greeks converted to Muslims overnight, which I think was very sensible. The Chinese gave a false impression. They were polite, accommodating, respectful. But I had two incidents with Chinese which told me how easy it was to underestimate them. One was the River Chun separates Singapore from the new territories, or at least the new territories from China proper.
This is Hong Kong?
Yes, Hong Kong. Now, when I was there, there was an actual state of starvation in the new territories, and the British were bringing rice in and distributing it on ration. Some Chinese were acquiring rice and taking it over the river and selling it on the Chinese side at a vast profit. And they got up to every trick. They had children carrying small quantities. One instance I know of personally, a pregnant woman wasn't pregnant, and somebody stuck a bayonet in and rice came out. And I said, well, it was obvious, sir, wasn't it? It's a bag of rice. I said, but suppose it could be a baby. Nah, he said, it was rice, you could tell, you know. But that actually happened. Anyway, we used to have patrols on the river to stop this. And about a mile from where my little Nissan hut was, I was actually on the bridge at that time, there was a crossing place. And we used to go down, one man lie up on the beach, and one or two more were 200 yards back up the track, you see. So the bad man with his two bags of rice would come down the track, past the first two. The one on the river would stand up and say stop, and the others would close him from the back and divest him of his rice, really. wasn't a very good thing to do, but you know, we all believed that we had to keep the rice in British territory. I went down with a sergeant and one morning at dawn, and I said, look, I'll tell you what, I lie up on the riverbank, you two hide behind that bush. That was agreed. Sure enough, along came a large Chinese man, had a bamboo stick on his shoulder, about 7 feet long, bag of rice on each end, and he came jogging down to the river's edge. And I stood up and said, stop, or halt, or something. And he stopped, very abject, dropped the bags of rice. And then he realised something. And I realised it at the same moment. I was unarmed. And he came towards me in a menacing fashion. So I picked up his bamboo pole, hit him as hard as I could, and shouted, help! And the sergeant came running down the track. He was armed. And this Chinese man plunged into the river and waded across. But I thought, oh, you know, these guys have teeth. But you tend, if you're one of the colonial power, you tend to forget that. And another night I was staying in the Peninsula Hotel, which is now, couldn't afford to stay there now. And in the well behind my room, two or three Chinese were beating another Chinese. I thought they were beating him to death. Apparently he'd got into their quarters and was trying to steal something. And they were holding him against the wall and pummeling him and so on. And I shouted down, as did one or two others, and they dragged him away. But one got, I think, the colonial power very often got the idea that the natives actually enjoyed being ordered about. But, you know, Indian Mutiny tells you. And my personal experience told me that this isn't always the case. Very respectful, as long as you're in a powerful position. But if you're not, then watch out. I came back from the Far East, convinced that the British had lost face in a huge way. We had behaved foolishly, and the British Empire wasn't going to last very long. And of course it didn't.
How had we behaved foolishly?
Well, for example, in Singapore, we believed profoundly that the Japanese couldn't attack from the landward side, whereas, of course, they landed, commandeered all the bicycles in the area, and pedalled down through the rubber plantations, which are like a forest of columns, if you like. There's not undergrowth and bushes and stuff like in Epping Forest. And I think the fact that so many, I've forgotten the number, you'll know it, but the number of British troops who landed and surrendered immediately, I thought that was disgraceful. They might not have won, but they could have put up a show. They still outnumbered the Japanese very substantially. And then, of course, sending a couple of battleships without air cover, and they were sunk in about 5 minutes. You know, we're looking at the perception of people, local people, who had thought we were invincible. And then just in case they hadn't got the message, of course the French gave them another opportunity to learn it at Bien Dien Phu. So they are. Otherwise I had a good time in the Far East, very nice.
Then you were demobbed?
Yes, I was sent to Ping Chau, where there's an immediate queue at my door of people wanting medical treatment. So I gave them all medical treatment. Half of them had paddy sores, great festering sores on their legs. So what you did then, you selected a comfortable seat, instructed some poor marine or other to pull these dressings off. And then you poured iodine in the wound. And they didn't half jump about. But they didn't say anything. They didn't shout. The others, we if they were constipated, we gave them the necessary. And everybody else got seasick pills, which didn't do any harm. And maybe they felt better. I don't know. But then one day I was told to go down to the docks and report with about six other marine officers. And as we got onto the ship that was taking us from Hong Kong to Trincomalee. I fell in with my pal with whom I joined up in 1943. We came home, made a big mistake. I went in an aircraft carrier from Hong Kong to Singapore. Singapore I got off, and a truck came and took us to the Army Transit Camp. There was about six of us. And the next day an Army man came and started telling us what to do, and I said, I'm terribly sorry, we're not in the Army, we're in the Navy, we're Marines. Ah, he said, oh well, you can have rations here. So I then rang the Naval, don't know what he was called, the chap down at the dock in charge of movement control. I said, a terrible mistake has occurred. Oh yes, he said, what's gone, old chap? I said, well, I'm in the Royal Marines, you see, and I'm at this dreadful Army transit camp. Oh my God, he said, what can we do? I said, well, let's have some transport. So he sent up a 1,500-weight truck and a Malay driver, and we toured Malaya. Had a lovely time. High spot of which was when we were talking among ourselves about climbing rubber trees. And the driver stopped the truck and he said, you like, Sam, I show you. So I said, you do that. So he jumped out and climbed a rubber tree, put a piece of rope round it, and lifted himself up. Anyway, that was good fun. And then when we left Singapore, we had a choice of which vessel we took, and we took passage in a Pacific repair ship. It was like an ordinary cargo boat, but full of machinery. And he took us to Trincomalee, where the Tamil Tigers now, well actually I think the Tamils have been annihilated in that part of Ceylon, they've all gone up to the north, which again is a great tragedy. Such lovely people, lovely place. And we were all richly entertained when we got there, because we were on a Royal Naval ship and he couldn't get it onto the buoy, kept missing. Anyway, we were there, and then we went round to the Colombo side, where I got a billet in the La Linea Hotel, where as you emerge from the surging surf, little boys run forward with pineapples held by the spiky end, all peeled, ready to eat, you see, always lovely. And then you sit down, they pour water over your feet so you can get your shoes on. I could have got used to that. But then I made my big mistake. I had a choice of leaving Colombo on a landing ship, brackets tank, which was coming back to England, or leaving on the HMS Indomitable. The university year was about to start, so I chose to come back on the Indomitable. But the ones who came, some of my pals came back on the landing ship, and they had a very good time. They went up the coast of India, calling it Bombay and places. It took them about 3 months to get home, but I came back on the Indomitable. Made my way back to Chatham, was issued with a grey sports jacket and trousers and a tie and a Trilby hat. And I gave the Trilby hat to a man who was standing outside Chatham Station. We almost missed the train. As I galloped past him, I said, you want a hat, mate? Give him the hat. And went home.
What about these war crimes trials you mentioned?
Oh, well, that's quite interesting. First of all, it was incredibly boring. A courtroom and a judge on a dais, and directly opposite the judge was the entrance to the courtroom, double doors, with a clock on the wall and two armed guards with Sten guns. And when I spent a morning there, and they were questioning a Japanese man about an alleged atrocity where some people had been shot, and from what I could gather, his defence was these people had been trying to get into some Japanese place where they shouldn't have been. Well, you can imagine, you see, the question is put to the man. And then he replies. Then that's translated into English. Well, these people were running towards me. So then another question is formulated. But wasn't it obvious they were harmless? And the nong-nong-nong, ding-dong, went on like this. And I thought it would be quite interesting, but it was terribly boring. However, there was a very interesting incident. Halfway through the cross-examination, very hot, everybody's half asleep, and the door at the back of the courtroom opened. And a man looked in. And then he said something to the guards, and said something to somebody outside, and the double...